talk about the second precept and entitlement and life and death. See if I can link those all together. And as far as life and death goes, I've been I was asked to give the talk, so thank you, Michael, for
putting me
on the hot seat. And today it's especially hot. The second precept is no stealing. And we're asked to train oneself to avoid taking what is not given. So, this morning I found a little milk in the refrigerator that I took without asking. And so, in my endeavor to explore the issue, I endeavored to make mistakes in order to explore deeper what things actually mean.
Also, you needed the milk, right?
And I needed the milk. Or I thought I needed the milk. And sometimes what we think we need, we don't actually need. So it's part of what, when avoid taking what is not given, then it's like you're waiting for someone to give, to offer, to waiting for others' generosity or the generosity of the circumstance to give so you may receive, so I may receive. And I think part of not stealing can also be looked at in terms of when you are given something, that you properly receive it, because to improperly receive a gift can also be a taking of the full generosity that may be manifest in that moment, in that gift. Someone gives you something and it's not really what you wanted, and so you think, oh, I'm looking at a gift horse in the mouth, or I don't really need this, but how do I accept this? So how to, and to not accept, to not accept the full generosity of what is given is in a way demeaning and belittling what could fully be a rich moment. So Dogen in the Shoji, he expresses, when birth comes, face and actualize birth. When death comes, face and actualize death. And moment by moment we can do this, even in Zazen with our breathing. Is the beginning of a breath, the birth of a breath, is the finishing the exhalation and fully being present with our exhalation, and then noticing when the inhalation begins. Is that the ending of a death and the beginning of a birth? Of the next breath that keeps cycling through, and then is our full our full inhalation, when our chest is fully expanded and the oxygen is able to reach all the surface areas of our lungs, and the surface area of our lungs is larger than the surface area of this room. The folds of our lungs are like that, that then we must exhale because of it's a natural, at some point the CO2 levels build up high enough where we must exhale our breath. And is as we exhale the CO2 out of our lungs, are the indicators in our lungs saying, okay, the CO2 isn't there anymore, or is it still building? So you have to take another breath of oxygen to neutralize that, those impulses that are naturally going on within our breathing. So there's really a lot of examination of the beginning and ending of our breath, and from that other things that arise. So I wonder if when we go for a walk and we need a hiking stick and we look in the woods and we find a stick that suits us, is that a taking from the woods? Are we taking something that was there, was the workings of the creatures in that location, are we taking from the woods? We use the stick and then maybe we bring it back to the woods and it might be in a different location. So we've relocated entire neighborhoods of microbes and insects into a new vistas for them. And how do we serve as a proper host in just a subtle action like that? During Zazen, we can experience the birth of an idea. We can, an idea can be a project to do, and how we're going to accomplish the project, and how we ripen the circumstances so that it can fully develop. And just like with birth, birth isn't just a sudden, just manifestation. In a way, it is a sudden manifestation. When a baby is born, it's suddenly in the world. And yet there's all of these preconditions that allowed that to happen, from the mother being born, going through puberty, developing the reproductive capacity, to the insemination and then the development of the baby and the taking the care and then the arrival of the baby. The birth is a totally ripe experience, and it can, and it's best not to be underripe, and it's not best to be overripe, because it can harm the lives of those, of the mother and the child. And so, and yet it can't happen at it makes it really difficult for things to survive if things aren't fully ripe. And likewise, it's best to have dinner when things are fully, properly cooked. And so there's a proper ripening, and oftentimes we may steal in order to ripen a situation that we think we need to have develop. And yet if we knew that we could wait, or know that we could wait for the proper fulfillment that of the conditions, that sure enough it would happen. When an apple on a tree fully ripens, it finally lets go and falls to the ground, and it's entered a gate. It is past a door. It is no longer able to stay attached. The stem disconnects from the limb and it falls. And there's no returning. It's a totally new situation that brings new opportunity. So, in ripening opportunities, how to be insightful about how things are ripening, and oftentimes it's hard to accept how things are ripening, and I think about entitlement a lot for some reason. Just because I'm a white guy, you know, I'm an educated white guy. I'm an educated white guy in the United States and California, in a premium part of this state in the Bay Area. I get where I get to work and where I get to live are just unusual things, and I just feel like a thief. I don't understand, you know, I could feel like, yes, I'm entitled to all of this, but I don't. I feel like a thief. I steal away in the morning to head off to work, and I steal a glance as I drive down Skyline towards the east, and I see the Bay Area, whether it's covered in fog or it's crystal clear and the sun's coming up. I steal a glance to the east, and I look to the westward hills of the Santa Cruz Mountains as the hills dive into the mist and the fog. And I feel like a thief, you know, just able to appreciate and witness and enjoy this. And I'm sure there's a penance for that, for stealing of such vast things. And I'm looking for that penance somewhere. I'm a Zen priest. I've been ordained by Michael. I feel kind of. There's a can be a burdensome quality of being a priest, of the obligations of being a. What are the duties? What are the responsibilities that are there? There are some priests that do it for many reasons, for either childhood aspirations, a calling. Some do it because it's like. That's what I want to do. That's what I want to be. That's the level I want to achieve. I like that guy. I want to be able to do what that guy does. And so there might even be a greed associated with being a priest. And once becoming a priest, feeling entitled to be respected because as a priest. And when one achieves a goal, it's kind of nice to enjoy the fullness of having achieved the goal. Begin exploring what it is. And then you find out all the troubles that are associated with it. So along with what the duties are, there are obligations. And I think obligations and entitlements might have might be corollary aspects. But again, as being a white guy well-educated in this place. There's can also be a tendency to make some assumptions that are blind assumptions. And I guess that's what I hope to recognize. There's always the hierarchy that exists, whether it's in a temple or in a workplace. There's a hierarchy that develops among men. There's a hierarchy among women. There's a hierarchy between men and women. And I guess I like to examine the hierarchy aspects because a lot of times, well, for me to examine the hierarchy aspects, there's freedom in from the hierarchy and in being able to see how it functions. And yet, when you're part of the hierarchy, it's important to manifest your part of it. And I'm part of the hierarchy here. I'm the maintenance oversight manager, and so I have to manifest being that. And at times, it's not what I want to do, and at times, I don't have time to take care of what there is to do. And so there's all these issues that can arise about it, but I think through the examination of them and the mistakes that are made, then new openings arise. The spiritual experience, the spiritual path is embodied in it within each of us. And there's internal and external qualities of it. I wear this rakusu, which has five miniature Joes, each with two fields. I don't know what the five represent, unless it's maybe the five skandhas. Then there's the okesa that we also wear, which has seven Joes, seven columns with three fields in each. And I'm not sure what the seven represent, except for a priest, it's seven, and for a teacher, it's nine or 12, or I don't know, they go up quite high for some long-lived teachers. But we chant in the morning. That we wear Buddha's teaching, freeing all beings. And when we talk of the Buddha's robe, are we talking about this? Are we talking about this? Are we talking about this? This as Buddha's robe, and I think this is what Buddha's robe is our body that we examine life with and we manifest our nature with. And so when we chant wearing the Buddha's teachings, freeing all beings, we each wear those teachings. And what is it to wear those? So one of the things I like about Zen and being here is, as a little kid, it's kind of a repeat of where I was as a little kid and driving across from Rapid City to Watertown, South Dakota with my dad. And we were going to visit Grandpa, and Auntie Amanda in the farmlands of eastern South Dakota. And I'd ask him questions just all the time, asking questions. Finally, you just get tired of answering the questions. And I'd say, why? Why is that happening, Dad? He said, well, it's for little boys to ask questions. And I find in Zen, I'm just endlessly asking questions too. And sometimes coming up with answers, but it's just forever examining. You know, I think that's what we do. We forever examine what's going on with us because it's always different. It's always changing. And when we talk about no fixed view, I wonder if that's a statement of what we need to aspire to, of not holding to fixed views, or if it's actually a fact that you cannot have a fixed view because moment to moment your perspective is changing. Even in considering entitlement and what it means, a person can understand the definition, the meaning of the word entitlement, which means to furnish with proper grounds for seeking or claiming something. Furnishing with proper grounds. So when you're furnishing with proper grounds for seeking or claiming something, furnishing with proper grounds, in a way you're fabricating notions that may give you grounds to seek and claim something. And I think examining those are useful from time to time. Yesterday, on Friday, I went to Pleasant Valley, which, if you visit Pleasant Valley, it's quite inhospitable. It's very dry. It's very flat. It's very hot. And it's also, there's some contagions in the air due to organisms in the soil that cause valley fever. And nearby is a prison, Pleasant Valley State Prison, in this desolate place. And about a third of the prisoners in that and in another prison nearby are being relocated because of their health problems associated with valley fever. But we go there. And this time went with Reverend Koan, who was here about a month ago. And he lives in Santa Barbara. And our Sangha brother, Don, who comes here frequently. And we went to the prison to conduct Buddhist services and went to the D-Yard Chapel, where about 12 of the inmates had assembled. They're black, they're Latino, they're white. And we had to wait for the Muslims to finish their Ramadan service. I thought Ramadan was at the end of the year, like around Christmas or something. But sometimes it's a different periods of time, I guess. And so the Muslim prisoners were conducting their service, their Ramadan service, and the agreed time for them ending was at 1:30, so we could be in there to conduct our services with the men. And 1:30 came and went, and 1:40 came and went. And I went into the chapel, which is like a classroom. It has the 12 by 12 square linoleum flooring. It has air conditioning. It has blank walls. It has a bunch of chairs and cheap rugs to that they can roll out and roll up. And the men were conducting their service and wondered if I could kind of help it along a little bit by being in there with them. Because I felt entitled. I felt entitled that, you know, it's your time's up. You know, it's our turn to have the chapel. And yet, it wasn't our turn yet. And yet, it felt like there was a power play ensuing where these prisoners were claiming their territory for longer than they wanted because they could. And I wondered, okay, so how do we deal with that? How do I deal with that? Meanwhile, Reverend Cohen and Don are outside. They're wondering what's going on. The other prisoners are getting a little agitated because here the Muslims are cutting into the Buddhist services. So there's all these different things going on that becomes like, wow. So finally, I got up from the chapel floor and got showed to the lead prisoner that was reading his remarks, and he raised his paper. I got one more page to go. I said, okay. And went outside, and our clerk, the head clerk for our Buddhist services, is the clerks might do several different religious groups, because there's Wiccans, there's Native American, there's Muslim, there's Catholic, there's Protestant, Seventh-day Adventist, Jewish services, Buddhist services. And our clerk, the head clerk right now, is actually a Buddhist, and he's serving 7 life sentences. And he's also a very go-getter as far as organizing things and getting more men to come to Buddhist services. He likes doing that. So when the Muslims finally finished, and there was a little tension there, you know, we went in and assembled, and a short while later, a sergeant came, and there was a little disturbance. I could tell he was disturbed. He says, "Are you guys here for long?" And we're all meditating. And then, so I got up and I went out and talked with him. And one of the head, George, the head clerk, you know, had actually called him to say, "Hey, you know, Muslims were taking too much time." And it's like, well, Ramadan ends next week. Why are you calling me? You know, don't be doing this. And so it really caused some turmoil. And I was a party to it because I felt like I needed to represent the men and that we were entitled to our time. So it's there are conundrums that arise, and I think there's no avoiding them. You know, one can decide to not act, or one can decide to act, and even by not acting, one is acting. One can think that they're doing it being very spiritual and doing what's right. I had a friend who visited the family farm in eastern South Dakota, and he, another white boy, since most of my friends are white. And he came to the farm, and my uncle had a horse. And the uncle said, "Hey, you know, you can take him out for a ride. Here's the bridle, put the bridle on, put a saddle on, climb on the horse." So he got on the horse. And the horse just stood there. And he just sat there. And after about 3 minutes, the horse didn't go anywhere. And he got off and he said, well, I guess the horse doesn't want to go anymore. So he chose to take a non-action and considered that it was really to impose his will on the horse's will is not something he wanted to do. So he chose to not do that. And that maybe the horse was happy to not go anywhere. He could get that saddle off and go back in and eat his hay. But there are other times where you must take the reins and you must go. So there's no stopping. Which brings me back to Dogen and his when he says, when birth comes, fully embrace and manifest birth. When death comes, fully embrace and manifest death. And so we do that with our breathing. During Zazen, we fully embrace it and watch it and study the nuance of breath. But we can also it is worth examining and internally and externally contemplating our breath. And one source suggests that, one Buddhist source and one of the Tripitaka Sutras says that for the sake of practicing insight, one at times can pay attention to another person's breathing. Then we can observe, witness, contemplate another being, their breathing, and their manifesting. And we do that from time to time. But I just find it interesting that for the sake of practicing insight, that at times it's useful to pay attention to another's breathing. And usually we think of our own enlightenment and our own manifestation. Yet it's important to witness the arising and the ceasing in others. And through that noticing, we develop more insight. We had he claimed himself to be a guest, but he was a resident here for a while, Gonzalo. And he had a box of books that he left. And one of them was this by Martin Buber, The Legend of Baal Shem, who is the founder of Hasidic Judaism. And Buber talks about rapture as one of the elements in Judaic studies, that the rabbis become enraptured in merging with God, and their breath can almost disappear, and they go pale, and they're with God, and then they come back. And it isn't just all about rapture, but the other hand is service to their brethren and to their communities. So there's rapture and there's service. And I thought, that's what we have. You know, you can go for full enlightenment, but you must come back and manifest yourself to help along what's going on. And I think when we help another, whether it's somebody's car is stuck and you help them push it out of a hole, or their car won't start and you help them go, or you're in the office and somebody's carrying something and you open a door for them. You're just, you know, we do what we can to help another get from place to place. And each of those helpings is contributing to our community in small ways and big ways. And so when we work alone, Buber talks about when a man sings alone, he can sing quite well. But when another joins his singing, joins in his singing, they can hit higher notes. And I think that's where the service element comes in, where when we join forces with others, when we do what we can, it helps each of us to perform to a higher level. And I wonder about that sometimes driving down the freeway. You know, when I'm entitled to be in the lane I'm in, because I'm there, when I've got my momentum and somebody else wants to cut in front of me, do I gun it to claim my territory, or do I allow him to move in the pattern that he's going and allow him to assist him in his movements? And from time to time, I notice drivers do that. They help one another in the driving. And I think you know, that's worth noticing, instead of just what I'm entitled to, the space I have. How does it mix in with the other people in the neighborhood? And that applies here at Jikoji too, where we each have our place to reside, and we each have our work that we do, and how do we help each other to do the best that we can do. And oftentimes it's hard to make it work out because of personal differences, and I've been through that. having differences with another, less inclined to help. So when I notice that, then I can maybe change my behavior. And examine what's really going on within me so that I can allow the field to remain as open as possible for each that's here as resident or guest or visitor. So that's about all I have. Anybody have any thoughts? Or questions or comments? Ms. Cliff?
Is the, on the second precept, the first precept has one of its many statements as being there is no killing of life. Is there something comparable in the second precept and some context behind it that supports that? I think there is a statement like that. No, there is no stealing.
Honoring the gift not yet given. Mm-hmm. The pure light precepts.
Mm-hmm.
The clear light precepts.
I've thought about this, and I haven't heard written, or heard, or seen written anything like that. But you know, here we are on this blue pearl, rotating, revolving around the sun, and with a solar system going around our galaxy. And how can we take anything and put it anywhere else than right here?
And just move it from one place to another. Just reposition it.
And so I like to practice that precept, that relocation part. And I actually, you know, kind of work with the whole notion of stealing. Like there is property, there are property rights, and our property has a definite boundary, and there are surveyed lines that are very hard to find where the corner pins are, because there are about 8 or 10 different ones in this odd-shaped parcel we have. But outside our parcel, there's some lovely moss-covered boulders. And to,
he heard this.
To go hunting the wild boulder and bringing it to a place where people can view it is, seems to be a joyful act of stealing or relocation. So in the bigger sense, we're just relocating it and giving it a visual opportunity for people seems to be useful. And on the stealing part, the thrill of stealing is still there, because it is fun to steal from time to time, even if it's from a field adjacent to us.
Yeah, kind of a bigger view too, that the
taking what is
I was thinking about the all our energy usage, that we're basically kind of parasitic, or we're taking from our history, we're taking mm-hmm. from this previous life of the plants and so on that mm-hmm. makes coal and oil and so on, and we're kind of eating our past in a sense, you know, mm-hmm. energy wise. So if that's part of, I wonder if it's offered. So it's a question about what if it's freely offered, if something is freely offered. Like, I've had that debate with myself when I've seen something in a dumpster. I presume something in the dumpster's offered because it's thrown away. So that's like free reign, but there's gray areas too, where things are objects or things are apparently abandoned or forgotten, and maybe of use, but strictly speaking, they haven't been offered to you. So, what do you do? Mm-hmm. You know, it brings up that same question. You know. Like the milk in the refrigerator.
Yes, Lance.
You mentioned property rights. Further extent of the gray. You know, the world is gray, isn't it? You know, this Russian philosopher Proudhon. Private property and stuff. Because how do these rules get? How did we go from just a universal commons to everything being divided up? This is my part, this is your part. It's complicated.
It is complicated, and it's also the foundation of our Constitution.
Sure.
I remember Barbara Jordan, she was a black congresswoman during the, I think it was the Watergate hearings, but she was a constitutional scholar, and she talked about how property rights are a fundamental part of our Constitution that I hadn't really thought about in the way she expressed it, but it really changed how... for individuals, for families, their circumstances to have the right to property, and they were the king of their property. And of course, it results in a whole, it's almost like that one thing just ended up tearing the whole fabric of this communal property thing into tiny pieces, and it was like a fractal of opportunities that occurred. And so then what becomes community property? And people get married and they own property, and then there's that communal property. And then, and so it's all these complications arise, which can be wonderful and distressing at the same time. And we deal with property rights here at Jikoji from time to time. Who owns this space? Who? What is our place when a group is renting here? When I got work to do, And I got to remember they own this place for now, and I'm here to help them have a good time. And so I think it's useful to examine property rights and to have them, it's nice to have joint property too, like parks. And did you have any other point about property?
Oh, I wasn't meaning to imply that property rights are useless. Only just all the different ways you can look at it. That it is gray. And the world's full of gray. I'm sure you know the Native Americans didn't understand that people could own the land. They didn't. Anymore than I think it was that he could own the sky. They didn't have that concept. There was no stealing of land because no one could own land to steal it in the first place. So just that precept thing, everything's cultural, I guess. It fit within the context of the people you're operating with. You have to respect their understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think, you know, taking something out of the trash within our cultural understanding. No problem. Probably not many people.
Thank you.
Yeah. Probably not many people are going to get on your case for moving a rock. You know, but somebody, you know.
That's why we do it.
Yeah.
And they're not at work.
Going into someone's house and taking something, a little different.
A little different. Yes, John?
I think the I'm not a constitutional scholar at all, but my sense is that the notion of property rights arose with the notion of individual human freedom, which probably goes back to the Magna Carta. We tend to forget that, coming from our Western history, that there was a period when a king owned everything. It was the king's realm. Therefore, one fine day, the king's representatives could come, knock on your door, and say, "You out. We are taking this, or you come with us. We're fighting a war." So, you know, we were all just vassals of the state, of the realm. And they're rather different. I think there was something that probably goes back to the cost of Reformation, the notion of being able to worship in a certain individual way, which gave rise to the notion that if an individual has a one-on-one relationship with his Almighty, he then should be accorded certain rights, which could be included in his family, his arm, his land. I know in Latin America, even today, the notion of private property still remains a deeply divisive one throughout Latin America. And there's still this notion that the very poorest people who are farming don't really own the property, if I'm not mistaken. And if we remember the slave period here, the notion of the sharecropper, after the Civil War. So, I mean, I don't know. I think it is a complex issue. Because if you have, I think, you know, in certain states, even today, is that even if you declare bankruptcy, they can't take your house. Not eminent domain, that's something else. So at least you're accorded some individual protection. Mm-hmm. So you say that, you know, at least you have a roof.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in Texas, actually. So
it applies in this state too.
Yeah. It does. So the notion of entitlement or boundaries, it's a kind of protection. You know, I think it was Robert Frost that said, "Good boundaries make good walls, make good neighbors.
Fences.
Good fences make good neighbors."
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yes. Chris?
Oh, I was just rubbing my face, but I'll throw something in. For me, the interesting aspect of this is the relationship between the absolute and the relative, but really the what you do. Like, you know, no killing, first precept. No killing means don't kill, or means you can't kill. But no stealing means you don't steal, or there's nothing to steal. So there's like an absolute, like you can't steal something because you already have it in a sense. Mm-hmm. But the relationship between that thought and how you go about living your daily life is the interesting thing for me. Because no killing doesn't mean you can't kill, so have your freedom to do whatever you want, because you're really, it's not possible for you to take anything. I mean, to me, that's the interesting aspect. I wondered if you had a comment about that. The relationship between how we live our lives and the relationship between the absolute, or the the absolute or the truth that we're really talking about.
To embrace birth and fully manifest birth, and to embrace death and fully manifest death when it comes, requires a fearlessness. To embrace what is here. And I think when one is afraid, then a lot of problems start to arise. For example, I have a brother-in-law in Texas who carries a pistol in his truck. And he likes to have it there because he thinks when the goons start to come, he's ready. And yet this guy has countless millions of dollars, several properties, all this, the toys, but he's got his guns to protect himself. And to me, the guy's, even though he's strong, intelligent, weapon-laden guy, he's afraid. He's really afraid of something happening. So he has no whiff of the absolute. And I don't know what he can do to do that, but it causes harm to those around him. And it can cause future harm to those around him. So I guess the fearlessness is an element that has to be considered when in going from the absolute to the relative. And maybe by exploring our fears, we can then more deeply understand where we are in that, in those relationships.
I would say that fearlessness comes into hand going from the relative to the absolute, for me. I mean, that's the scary part. You know, because I can abide by the social mores and the laws, and I understand how to live in society. But once I have a hint of something that is beyond that, something in a sense not comprehensible to my intellect, what do I do with that?
Mm-hmm. You mean like there's nothing to own. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to mm-hmm. actually own.
I mean,
so there's no stealing.
I mean, I understand.
To go to that
right.
place?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Like, I understand about the dumpster. There's a question there that you can make. You can choose an answer for that. But when you go to the, there's nothing to steal,
yeah.
There's nothing you can say about that, in a way. And that, to me, is... just the thought of it is overwhelming, and in a sense, when something's overwhelming, I'm not in control of it, and hence it threatens me, and hence I'm fearful.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine you go there, and then everything else. I mean, it seems like you go there and you come back. You go there to the absolute, you come back here, and there's a relationship somehow that maybe develops through practice.
Yeah, maybe there are some fears worth paying attention to, and when you have a dumpster where there's a lot of fresh vegetables with a few rotten ones in there, and it's colorful stuff, and you dive in, and it's like, yes,
And it's moving, and you see little wax. <waxes. laughs> It's like, whoa.
Sorry you got in there.
It is his dumpster.
Yeah. There you go.
There's I don't know if I can find this, but in number 38 of the Tao Te Ching, it says, those who are interested in service act without motive. Those who are interested in righteousness act with motives of all sorts. Those who are interested in propriety act and receive no response. They roll up their sleeves and use force. The Tao is lost, goodness appears. When goodness is lost, philanthropy appears. When philanthropy is lost, justice appears. When justice is lost, only etiquette is left. And it's polite to quit now to honor our Tenzo.